Great to have you with us for a Garden Talk here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, turning our attention to sugar beets. We can't grow sugar cane in Wisconsin, pretty sure of that, but we can grow sugar beets. And at one point, we grew a lot of sugar beets. The sugar beet industry was a significant source of income and employment for local farmers and laborers in the early 1900s. We're going to talk about the industry and the U.S. sugar factory, which has been repurposed as the Garber Feed Mill Project, with our guests now, as we turn to a couple of guests, actually. With us to talk about the Madison factory are Brian Marauder, who's part of the development team for the Garber Feed Mill. Brian, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
Well, appreciate having you here. And Tom Silke, whose great-grandfather helped build the factory in 1906. Tom, welcome to you.
Thank you, Larry. Great to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you with us. And, of course, we want to hear from you as you listen in. Have you ever raised sugar beets? Maybe your family was involved at one time. We had factories in many parts of the state, actually, at one point in time. I hope you'll join in. Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email to talk@wpr.org. Maybe we should most people aren't raising sugar beets here these days. Let's talk about how are they different from regular beets that we eat? Tom, go ahead.
Sure. Well, there are several different strains of beets, and the table beet that most people probably think of, the purple vegetable, is something that people see in salads and in various places. The sugar beet was much more of a production crop, kind of like what feed corn is compared to sweet corn. And it was grown throughout Europe and throughout the world, primarily to generate sugar. The U.S. industry was a little bit different in about 1906 or so. They began early efforts at sustainability. They began to look at the pulp from the sugar beets and the tops as cattle feed and as fertilizer, and began to utilize the entire vegetable, harvesting the sugar in a factory like the Garber Feed Mill, but then also shipping the pulp and the tops out to farmers to use for feed and fertilizer.
And I think maybe the first plant, it was somewhere around 1869, as far back as that, we had a plant, I believe, in Fond du Lac.
That could very well be. I'll give you a quick family timeline that'll help put a little context on it. My great-grandfather, Hans Struck, came from Germany with his father and his brother in 1884. He was 18 years old. They settled in Nebraska and began working in the sugar beet industry as farmers. They had been farmers in Germany, in northern Germany. And if you drive through Germany these days, you still see big piles of sugar beets out in the field. We think of sugar cane as the primary source for sugar. It is, but beets still provide a substantial portion of the sugar in this country and elsewhere. They began to travel. My great-grandfather lived in about 26 different cities, helping farmers bring together their crops, process it, and get it out to the sugar companies like American Sugar or U.S. Sugar Company, which was the one in Madison. It seems to be that there was a decision to kind of consolidate things because the Madison plant, when it was built around 1905, was equipped to handle 600 tons of sugar beets a day. That's a pretty big pile of sugar beets. And Brian, correct me if I'm wrong, but the early blueprints show 11 railroad spurs coming into that facility to handle fuel, the beets, the sugar, the remnants of that went back to the farmers. So it was a very substantial industry, and it employed a lot of people in Madison.
Yeah, and what's interesting about the Madison experience in particular is, you know, Madison at the time was a population of about 19,000. Imagine that. And the community leaders, the business leaders, wanted to see the population double. And so they saw exactly what Tom described as the possibility of growing the local economy by supporting this industry. And so a group named the 40,000 Club had a banquet for 1,000 farmers. Imagine that today, 1,000 farmers under one tent, and encouraged or got enough of them to agree to grow sugar beets that then eventually led to the sugar factory happening. And another local connection with the university, which Larry, I know you're close with, is the original president, Magnus Swenson, was on the staff of the University of College Agriculture and helped found the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. And so he was one of the main instigators, we believe, to really get the local community, the farmers, and others in the industry together to make this project happen.
And in addition, there were other professors from the university who were stockholders on the board of directors. Professor Russell, who was the dean of the College of Agriculture, was a stockholder. And the people involved would be names that people would recognize from street names and building names and so forth. And this was seen not only as an agricultural project. And by the way, UW had the first agricultural economics department in the United States, in the world. And it was right around 1908 that started. And this was an important component of that. So farmers started to interact with the business community. It was also considered a high-tech industry. I have some of the documents from the American Sugar Industry and Beet Sugar Gazette from the early 19. I'm probably the only subscriber left. But those early 1900s documents and publications, people were filing for patents. People were looking for new technologies. They were looking at new ways to process the food. Farmers were looking for ways to modernize their growth and harvesting and processing of their crops.
And so the factories themselves, I mean, what would the process have been like, Tom, for, of processing sugar beets? And again, they're different from the beets that we have. They're more of a fibrous thing, are they not, if I'm not mistaken?
Right. And in fact, in the original photos of the Garber feed mill, you'll notice that the superstructure of the building was much taller. There were smokestacks, but also there were areas that were five stories tall. Sugar beet processing involves moving the sugar beets up through a tower while you bring water. I think I'll get it right one way or the other, but it's either water coming down, hot water down and beets up, or the other way to kind of leach the sugar out of it and to leave the fibrous material behind. And they really needed what was then, again, high technology to have the hot water, to have the tower, to have the processing for doing this. And the farmers, as Brian said, they were harvesting 4,000 to 5,000 or 6,000 acres of farmland in this area for sugar beets. And again, with the kind of numbers like 600 tons a day during harvest season, they were moving a lot of material through and trying to figure out how to recycle the material and modernize their farming efforts.
Yeah. Yeah, you wondered what they would do with all that pulp.
Well,
some of it, some of it. I mean, that was one of the early challenges of the operation, which was originally known as the U.S. Sugar Company. The particular site that we're talking about, if you're familiar with Madison, is right behind Ulbricht Botanical Gardens. That's where it is now, the modern day Garber feed mill. And you've got the Starkweather Creek that leads to Lake Monona. So early on, the stories are that a lot of that residue from the processing ended up in the creek, which then ended up in the lake. And again, this is the early 1900s, and how we acquired ice was we harvested it from the lake. And so what ended up happening is that some of that yellow residual material ended up turning the ice, discoloring it. And there was a local company by the name of the Knickerbocker Ice Company that actually went out of business as a result of people not wanting to put discolored ice in their fridge areas or their root cellars or whatever they were using that for. So it did not come without consequences, that's for sure.
But today, that company would probably sell that water as vitamin water. It was probably full of nutrients and good things for you that they didn't appreciate because of the discoloration.
Well, and it would have reminded people of what urine looks like when it's, in snow or on ice.
Right. And
to be honest.
And keep in mind, this was, and Bryant probably knows more about this than I do, but this area of Madison was really marshland. It was not being used for anything. It didn't have the residential and industrial buildup that we think of today. And in fact, the iconic picture, I have to say this, of the two girls standing in front of the original building, we're pretty certain that that was my grandmother and her sister as girls growing up in Madison. And that small office building that's now used by Olbrich, but it was part of the original sugar factory, was my great-grandfather's office. My mom, as a little girl in the late 20s and early 30s, would go to her grandfather's office to play on Saturday mornings. And it was, there was nothing there. It was marshland.
It's an amazing story. So, how many years did it operate in this fashion? I mean, how many years did the sugar beets?
It was probably 20 years, right, Bryant?
Yeah, about 20 years. So in total, I think there were about 8 or 9 factories in Wisconsin. Today, Garver is really the only linkage to that beet factory once that existed throughout the state. But it eventually closed in 1927. And that's when it sort of went through its next evolution. And that's really kind of the fascinating story about this particular building is it's the thread of agriculture from the very beginning to today, which is the host of the Dane County Farmers Market in the late winter season. But after it closed down in the 1920s, there was an individual by the name of James Garver, and that's where the building gets its namesake from today. And despite the depression, he decided that he wanted to make it also a very high-tech facility. And he too has a connection to the University of Wisconsin. He had a master's degree in animal husbandry from UW. And what he understood was that that the farms, they were limited in their herd size by how much they could grow on their land. And if their way to kind of commercialize the process to add nutrients to the feed, that would create a tremendous amount of opportunity to create some business, to allow farmers to make more of their yields, and to ultimately help Madison grow its population, which was the original intent of the project. So a lot of people think about, you know, Garver as, you know, historic building because of its architectural beauty. It's really because of its contributions to the agriculture industry. And one of the real fascinating things Tom just explained, the original 5-story building, it was referred to as the Sugar Castle because of the sugar beets. Today you look at it and it's about 3 stories tall. And one of the great mysteries has been, well, what happened to those top 2 stories? Why would one take those off? And what happened to all that brick? Was it repurposed? Well, as we kind of dug in around the project, kind of like archaeologists putting in, you know, brand new utilities and so on and so forth, what we discovered was all of the old brick had been buried underneath the existing flooring system. So Mr. Garver and his ability to kind of keep things affordable decided that, you know, rather than shipping that brick out, he would just bury it and put a new flooring system on top of it. So as you walk around Garver today, you can kind of see evidence of that. You see some bricked-in archways that are very low. The windows on the main floor are basically at shin height. That makes no sense from a factory perspective on operating. You'd be walking around and breaking those windows all the time. Well, the reality is the original grade of that building went down 6 or 7 feet lower, and that old brick is just sitting right underneath where we're all walking today. It's kind of neat.
Talking today about sugar beets and the Garver Mill and the it's a wonderful building. And it's great to have our two guests with us today. Tom Silke, whose great-grandfather helped build the factory in 1906, and Brian Marauder, who's part of the development team for the Garver Feed Mill. Questions or maybe an experience of your own to share relating to it, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us here on Garden Talk, Larry Mealer, with my two guests as we talk about sugar beets in the Garber feed mill. Tom Silke, whose great-grandfather helped build the factory back in 1906, and Brian Moroder, who is part of the development team for the Garber feed mill. It's great to have them with us today. And questions, give a call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Again, love to hear from you. David in Dale, Wisconsin. We'll go to you. Hi, David.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
Well, I'm going to get kind of a family history in this. My people were Volga Germans. They went from Germany to the steppe region of Russia at the invitation of Catherine the Great to farm. And then eventually when they turned their backs on a promise not to inscript people into the military. So they all took off, and my family members went to Nebraska and the Dakotas and Iowa as migrant sugar beet pickers.
Ah, migrant sugar beet pickers. Tommy, are you familiar with any of the history about that?
Well, again, you know, my great-grandfather's family came to this country probably for some of the same reasons and settled in Nebraska. Those same states were some of the places where, you know, he started out as a farmer and it ended up becoming a construction engineer and overseeing the building of dozens of these plants. And the people who farmed, and Russia was also a big center for sugar when beets were the primary source of that. And keep in mind that a lot of these areas, and Wisconsin's a great example, have very sandy soil, and people were trying to find the crops that they could grow. You know, potatoes do well. I have two tree farms in the middle of the state, one of which has been in our family for 175 years, and we grow trees, pine trees, because they do well in sandy soil. And people like the itinerant farmers knew how to handle crops and soil conditions like those found here, hard winters, sandy soil, clay soil, whatever, and to find ways to do that. And they came to this country and managed to find their way into these industries and to move from their original jobs, usually as teenagers, into management or into business, into technology development, all of that. And Madison was a key location for that.
Yeah. I think now sugar beets are grown in the U.S., primarily Minnesota and North Dakota, I think, are the centers of powers when it comes to sugar beets. David, thanks for our day. David, I'm sorry. Thank you for your story about your family. Dick in Brooklyn has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Dick.
Hi. I have a question about your family. There was a professor in biochemistry named John Garber, who I worked with at one time, and I think his wife ran an art gallery in Madison. I'm wondering if they were descendants of the Garber family that operated the Garber mill. And just an aside, I can remember on the farm as a kid, my dad feeding Garber feeds.
Dick, thanks a lot for calling. Brian?
Yeah, there seem to be a lot of Garbers around Madison, so I wouldn't doubt that there is some relationship there. And I love hearing these stories. You know, as someone who's been involved with this building and the renovation of it for now over 12 years, starting back in 2013, I've been kind of the caretaker of some of this history. And, you know, the number of people that I get to meet or reach out to us and, you know, share these amazing stories about, you know, these different time periods where it's, you know, just like the gentleman who called, where, you know, they came up with their pickup truck and pulled up the ramp that's still there today and filled up with some feed, or the kids who once played in the building when it was vacant for 20 years and, you know, kind of became a place for teenagers to let off a little bit of steam. It at one time was known as the Graffiti Museum of Madison, which we've, you know, done our best to pay homage to. It's just wonderful to kind of hear these stories and how this building has played such an important part of people's individual lives, as well as both the local and the regional economy for now 120 plus years.
Yeah, I can. Go ahead, Tom.
I was going to say it's also one of the places you could go to a museum and see exhibits about history. when you step into the Garber feed mill, and every and I live in the Milwaukee area, but I travel to Madison regularly enough, and I stop in every time. Coffee, they actually sell beet ice cream, so anybody who is a big beet fan can find, you know, could get their fix of beet ice cream at Garber. But when you step into the building, you really immerse yourself in the history of that building.
Yeah.
as a feed mill and as a beet factory, and in Madison's East Side history. And it's really, it's an unusual feeling because you feel like you're there.
It's so amazing. And I've, you know, for years and years and years and years, I drove by that area and I kept looking at that building and saying, it's such a shame to see that building going into disrepair as it, you know, was certain, you know, slowly going that way for many, many, many years. And Brian finally got it put together.
Yeah, I mean, I give a lot of credit to the community and the neighborhood as well, too. I mean, they really saw this, you know, building similar to you as, you know, more than just a factory. It was a really symbol of the community's and, you know, ability to sort of reimagine and reinvent itself time and time over and over again. There were some students at the university who did some thesis on the possible future of Garber during that time period, I think gave the neighborhood a lot of strength and some ideas. And ultimately, as the building was facing demolition, similar to its sister factories throughout the state, a group came together and said, you know, we got to give this one more chance. And to their credit, they took they hired a local photographer by the name of Zane Williams. He did a great photo documentary of kind of the building. And it got to the point where the community, the city of Madison said, you know what, we're going to give this one last chance. And that's where our organization stepped in and, you know, created what we have today.
It's
a great example of continuity, you know, through decades and decades and decades.
It's a marvelous building, and I'm so happy, as I think everybody in Madison is and outside of Madison is, with the result. And for those who haven't been there, Brian, maybe, you know, just describe a little bit about what's going on in there. I've been in there so many times. I live on the East Side, so it's easy. I can walk there almost from where, you know, pretty much.
Well, what I love about Garber is there's always something for everyone, for your Garden Talk listeners. Garber, we think, is the largest indoor household plant store in Wisconsin. As you've seen in the last couple of years, we're full of plants, which is an opportunity for people to come and look at, you know, literally thousands of plants. We're right behind Olbrich Botanical Garden. So they make a really nice 1-2 combination. You come over to Garber, you get some ice cream, some pizza, some coffee, and then head over to Olbrich or vice versa. And then throughout the week, there's just all sorts of activities. If you're a family, we've got things like family or parent child happy hour. We've got workshops that people can take, craft workshops with one of our organizations called Glitter. We've got often live music on Friday nights during the summer. We've got Food Truck Friday. So it's 15 different businesses that are located inside the building, you know, and just great people. It's just, many of them are connected also to the food industry or to food system. So Sitka Salmon, our Sitka Seafood Market, Reap Food Group, Nasala Kombucha, these are all local food businesses or food organizations. And it just, you know, to me, it's just really interesting how this has come full circle from its original days as a beet factory to then a feed mill, and now to a place where people can, you know, have an experience that all involves food and is very supportive of the agriculture industry in so many different ways.
Yeah, it's just a fun place to go. I mean, you get revitalized every time you go there because there's always something going on. People are excited to be there. They're all in a good mood, sometimes in a buying mood, sometimes in a just look around mood. But it never fails to impress, I don't think. And Tom, something in the last 20 seconds here, something you got to be a little proud of too.
Well, I was going to mention Bryant, you know, took the laboring oar on this project early on, and one of the Madison newspapers contacted my mom. You know, had traced her lineage to Hans Struck, who, by the way, founded Struck and Irwin on Willie Street. And his daughter was his daughter's brother-in-law was John Findorf, who started Findorf. So they had construction in their blood as well as agriculture. But my mom was so pleased. And I think she's characteristic. She grew up on Jennifer Street, characteristic of the east side of Madison, wanting to see their legacy carried forward, and thrilled that there was a way to do it so well.
And they've done, and it's been wonderful. And I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Brian Moroder, part of the development team for the Garber Feed Mill. Tom Silke's great grandfather helped build the factory in 1906. We'll talk about this again. I thank you very much for being here, guys, and thank you for listening. And please stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News right through the afternoon. I'm Larry Mueller.